In our last three studies of Paul's concern for his kinsmen according to the flesh, his apostate brethren, and his grief and deep-seated sorrow that he experienced on a recurring basis, we looked at the fact that the grief and sorrow was rooted in the fact that the Israelites had the adoption held out to them as a real future potential for any of them that would believe God, and yet they hardened their hearts against that. And then we saw that the glory, which is, in my understanding of it, the foundation for the adoption, because as we are transformed from glory to glory, we become more and more Christ-like in our character. The adoption is the final event that will solidify our participation in the kingdom, but we can't participate in that kingdom without this glory having been developed. So the glory is undergirding the final act, the adoption as sons. And then we back up one step from the glory to the covenants, where God actually makes some formal commitments to certain Israelites for the nation's benefit, and that's the foundation for their participation in the transforming glory, and then the adoption issue of being judged by the Father as competent to enter into the inheritance and begin to exercise authority over that inheritance, because the covenants are, fundamentally, things to be believed. They're not things to be done. I'm not opposed to doing. I'm not opposed to obedience, but I am opposed to putting obedience ahead of everything else, because it's too easy to fake. Obedience flows naturally out of what you believe, but a constant focus on obedience leaves what am I supposed to believe that's supposed to lead to this obedience kind of in the shadows, and people that aren't sure what they're supposed to believe don't typically obey. They put on a front. I mean, they put on a good show, but it's not real obedience. So the whole issue here is that God is working in the process of bringing us to the adoption as sons. He wants to settle us into our inheritance in the place of service in the kingdom of Messiah as a permanent, eternal reality, kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. So we took our time in dealing with the issues of those three things. But in the last set of three, where he talks about the giving of the law, the temple service, and the promises, it seems to me that he's reiterating, he's going back over the same three things from a little bit different perspective, because the Israelites had been subjected in exposure for blessing, the issues that Paul is dealing with here and is causing him such grief, they had been subjected to things that if they had believed them, they would have entered into the blessing of them. But Paul is actually, in the list here, in the last three things, talking about the giving of the law, which is technically the legislation of the national covenant or the national constitution of the nation of Israel as a theocracy. And then he moves from that to the temple service or the service. The word temple is in italics because it's not there. But the idea of the service is the service of the temple. It's the Levitical practices that went on in the tabernacle and then later in the temple over and over as instructive issues for the people. And then the promises, which is a return to the issue of the covenants. So I really think that there's some connections here, but I think the connection is an issue of trying to focus on the divine methodology in view of the inheritance over which we are going to be given authority as adopted sons. So it's a methodology issue, and the giving of the law was one of the first issues in the methodology. The temple service was the second issue in the methodology, and then the promises was the final issue, but it was the most fundamental. So we're going to look at all three of them. That's why I said we're going to get a little whiplash this evening. Instead of going through each one over the next 3 weeks, we're going to just deal with them. And part of the reason why that is because I can assume that you guys are all on the same page with me in terms of what I'm going to say, and that makes it easier to go more rapidly rather than having to make sure everybody understands, because you already do. So let's just start with the giving of the law. The giving of the covenant of the law at Horeb. And it was a covenant. I mean, in Deuteronomy, where we went over the land covenant last time, it says, not like the covenant at Horeb. Well, that was the Mosaic law. That was the giving of the Ten Commandments and all the instructions for all of the tabernacle building and all of the stuff that was given on the mount. So that was an issue, but it had a temporary part to play in the general history of humanity, because Israel was being selected as a nation, given a constitution by their God as a theocratic kingdom where God was the king, Israel were the subjects of the king, and it was for the benefit of the nations as they beheld God's dealings with Israel so that they would be attracted to his righteous rule. Didn't work out that way, but the giving of this law, the covenant at Horeb, was, or at least had, two very distinctive purposes revealed in the scriptures. One of the first issues, or the first of these two distinctive purposes, I think, is revealed in Psalm 119. Because Psalm 119 is the longest chapter in the whole Bible. It's 176 verses. And the 176 verses come out because the author of the psalm took every letter of the Hebrew alphabet and developed 8 verses for each letter. And he starts out with Aleph, and he has 8 verses, and Beit, and then 8 more verses, and he goes all the way through the alphabet, all the way down to the end. And 8 times 22 is 176. So that's how come there's 176 verses. But the issue of these 176 verses was that the law was an extraordinary revelation of the truth about God as he is. The psalmist extols the benefits of the law. There's a significant level of enthusiasm through the whole psalm for the enormous benefits that can be derived from the knowledge that the law reveals. The law, as a revelatory tool, makes all kinds of declarations about the truth, particularly about what God is really like, and it's a framework for learning how to relate to him. But the law itself had tremendous positive impact in terms of its revelatory identity, because there were enormous benefits from knowing the truth about God. However, there is this about that psalm. It begins in verse 1 with the declaration of the blessedness of those who walk in the law of the Lord. Oh, how blessed are those who walk in the law of the Lord. That's how it starts. And 176 verses later, or 175, I guess, there is the end of the psalm, and the end of it is a plaintive admission. I have grown astray like a sheep. So you have this conundrum that the law is a fantastic revelation of truth as it is in God, but it's also, in a subtle sort of way, a very clear revelation of man's inability to walk in the law of the Lord. I mean, you cannot live up to the reality of who God is and what he's like. Paul said it this way in the New Testament. He is the God who dwells in inaccessible light. No man can approach the light of God. That's the way Paul addressed it in his letters to Timothy, or one of his letters to Timothy. So you have this fact that Psalm 119 is the longest chapter in the Bible, is full of enthusiastic expression of the benefits of the revelation contained in it. But it also ends on this sour note, if we can call it a sour note, where the psalmist recognizes that he has gone astray like a sheep. So in spite of verse 1, how blessed are they who walk in the law of the Lord, he ends up saying, I haven't been there. I haven't been walking. I've walked in my own way. I've gone astray just like a dumb sheep. nibbling here and nibbling there and going to get a drink there and not even paying any attention to the reality that I'm living in. That's what sheep do. So on the one hand, the covenant of the law, where he talks about the legislation, to whom belongs the legislation, the giving of the law, you had this split reality that Israel was given this phenomenal revelation concerning their God, but then there was this undercurrent of revelation about what they were like and what a humongous difference there is between God and these sinful Israelites. So on the one hand, you had this purpose of extraordinary revelation, but according to Paul's theology of the law in the New Testament, that's revealed in multiple places, but particularly like in Romans 3:20 and 23, where he says nobody is justified by the works of the law, because by the works of, or by the law is the revelation of the knowledge of sin. And then three verses later, he says, "For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God." We have come short of the character of the God who is revealed by the law, in terms of his extraordinary character, in terms of moral realities. So you have Romans 3:20 and 23, where the law peels back the covers that hide man's bondage to sin and expose his utter failure to walk in the law of the Lord. The law does that to people. It peels back the facades, and people react to it in one of three ways. There are those who feel the peeling of the skin or the layers, and they hate it, and so they shut it down, and they won't allow those layers to be peeled back, so they ignore the law. And there are others who sense the peeling back, and all they can get out of that is despair. There's no hope here. There's no hope for me here. Because this law is a revelation of a God who's untouchable and unknowable in terms of the reality of walking in his light, walking in his law. And then there's the third kind who says, okay, the scriptures say God's truly like this, and it says, I'm truly like this, but the gospel says God has made a way for these two to come together. I don't lose my sinfulness, and he doesn't lose his holiness, but we do have this fellowship in his light to some degree or another. And that's where the grace of God fills in a huge amount of stuff. So you have that in Romans 3, and then in Romans 7, verse 9, the law has an extremely detrimental effect upon fallen man in goading him into rebellion. Paul says, I'm not the one that's sinning. It's sin that dwells in me, and I was alive apart from the law, but when the law came, sin revived, and I died. So the law had this detrimental effect on fallen humanity. And then in 1 Corinthians 15:56, he actually says that the sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. So the law is actually used by sin to bring its dominion over men to completion. Men are in bondage to sin because of the law. So one of the things that Paul has in his theology about the law, the giving of the law, was that God's purpose for law, according to Galatians, was to school men in terms of their absolute incapacity to live in harmony with the God as he is, as long as they don't begin in the right place. If we begin in the right place, we can actually benefit from the law, but we have to begin in the right place. And according to Galatians, the law was a tutor to bring us to Christ, which means it was schooling us to begin in the right place. Well, man's typical place of beginning with God is rooted in his confidence in himself as an independent actor in God's creation. That's the fundamental impact of the temptation in Genesis 3 to the "you shall be as Elohim" concept that Adam and Eve bought into, hook, line, and sinker. The you shall be as Elohim means, basically, that you can act as an independent actor, as a creature in God's creation, and you can confidently depend on your own skills and abilities, because Satan's lie was that God's not as good as he's cracked up to be, and you need to be able to protect yourself from him. Totally irrational argument. You can't protect yourself from omnipotence. You mix omnipotence and omni-wisdom and omniscience into a mix, and there is no way that you can win as an independent actor trying to protect yourself from that. But nonetheless, that's the typical beginning place, and it shows up everywhere. But one of the classics is with the giving of the law. In Exodus 19:8, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. That was Israel's response to the law. An admirable declaration, but nonsense. There was no way they were going to do all that. They thought they could, but their antagonism toward God over the centuries, because they could not do what he was demanding that they do, at least in their understanding of it, just drove their rebellion to the point of so much rage that when the lawgiver actually came into the world to fulfill the law for the sake of those who couldn't, they murdered him. That was how deep their rage and animosity was toward God because of the law, because they started in the wrong place. They started with the assumption that I can be an independent actor and depend on myself to make my life good by doing what God requires of me with certain controls that I place on the process. That's a terrible beginning spot. So, the only really workable place of beginning with God is believing him. And the believing is always attached to promises. And promises are always attached to the reality that he that makes a promise is the one who's obligated to keep it. So faith in promises that God's going to fulfill is a totally different starting place. There is no place for confidence in myself. There is only confidence in the fact that God has made this promise, this covenant commitment, and he will bring it to pass, and all I have to do is trust him to do that. That's the issue of trust. And once trust is in the mix, not trust in myself, but trust in him, I'm at the beginning point. And so the law actually forced men to come to grips with whether or not they were doing what they were told to do in the law. And the only answer that an honest person could answer was no. And if no is your answer, then you've got to look for another solution to the problem of relating to God without condemnation. And the only alternative is promise. So law and promise became strong antagonists in the thinking of Israel, because Israel was under the dominion of the prince of the power of the air, and he was twisting their understanding of the purpose of law, and he was grinding their rage into intensity that would actually cause them to do the most wicked thing imaginable in the creation of God, and that's to try to put him to death. So, the law was a revelation of the perfections of God, and by implication, the perfections of this inheritance that the adoption is going to bring about. And it was a revelation of the utter need of men to somehow be transformed into those who can take up residence and authority in that inheritance. So that's the way the law was used as a tutor, and that's Paul's theological structure for it, because he says, wherefore then the law in Galatians? So his whole point there is that God had a purpose for the law, and it was given 430 years after the promise had been made. And the reason it was given was because in that 430 years, there was a degeneration in the offspring of Abraham in the matter of faith in the promises. Every generation from Abraham, 430 years down the road, was a degeneration of faith. There's a reason why Joseph was basically the only one of the sons of Israel who stands out as a man of faith. The rest of them were all They had departed from the principle of trusting God for the promises he'd made. And when you start down that path, God can either say, okay, I'm done with you, go your way, you'll come to the end of it one of these days when I bring you to judgment, and that'll be the end of you in terms of any kind of relational reality. Or he can come up with a method for applying pressure to get them to turn. And the law was the pressure. The law was the school teacher with the rod in its hand to whack you when you weren't paying attention, and to do the tutoring to bring you to Christ. So that was the giving of the law. That was something that Israel had been privileged with. And it was a part pain, part blessing, or part pleasure thing, because on the one hand, the pain was being told what you really are, and the other hand was telling you what God's really like, and holding out this possibility of an inheritance in his kingdom through the Abrahamic covenant promises. And so the question is, how do we get there from here? So that's the beginning of the issue of the adoption. How do we get here from there from here? And I think that that's why Paul in Romans 8 talks about the adoption as the redemption of the body. Because that's the last part of the whole process of getting us to there from here, when our holiness is brought to fulfillment by the regeneration of the physical body, the conversion of the soul, and the writing of the law in the heart, in the new heart promise God made, so that we go into that inheritance free and righteous and holy and glad. So there's a link in Paul's list that puts the adoption in parallel with the legislation, as the adoption is the objective and the giving of the law was part of the means to that end. So that's the beginning. And then he goes to the service. The New American Standard puts the temple service. This is the service of the sanctuary, whether temple or tabernacle or whatever. But this service was all that the law specified as to how the activities in the tabernacle and the temple were to function. There were rules for this, and there were rules and instructions for that. And there was this piece of furniture that signified certain things. And you had to respond, you had to relate to all of this with the overriding fact that the glory of God was in the inner section of the tabernacle, and nobody could go in there except the high priest once a year, and he couldn't go in there just casually. There was no casual Friday for the Day of Atonement, or the day when he could go in there once a year. Very particular rules, and you could die if you went in there without meeting those regulations. So the book of Leviticus is a very detailed prescription of all of the stuff that had to be done, and the priesthood of the temple, that priesthood was to function as the mediator or the mediation for Israelites, because the priests were supposed to teach the people by word and practice, and they were to teach them in practice by implementing all of the various functions of the temple worship. The people were supposed to learn from that. The author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 9 that these various functions of temple worship were both type and pattern. And he deliberately says that they were pointing to the greater reality in the heavens, the temple in heaven, the tabernacle in heaven. In other words, it was a shadow on earth of the good things of the heavens in the tabernacle there. So the details of what the priests were doing, why they were doing it, how they were doing it, and all the particulars were all designed to teach in form what the words said about being able to relate to God as he is, in his light. It was a matter of Israelite blessedness in the sense that the forms of the service made more explicit the words of divine revelation that had been declared. Everybody pretty much knows that human beings learn better by being involved in precise guided activity, except for dads, when they're putting the bicycle together Christmas Eve and don't want to read the instructions. But dads who don't read the instructions end up teaching their sons how to do it by taking them through the process so they don't make the same mistake that dad did. Well, that's God's methodology, is create these types and patterns as forms so that as you go through this process, you begin to realize some of the most fundamental realities about God and men and how you're supposed to relate to Him and that kind of thing. So the glory was made far more explicit in the service than the verbal revelation of the law was able to do. You could have all these rules and regulations, but they were just so many rules and regulations until you actually had to do something every day or whatever in functioning according to what those instructions required. And probably you, like I have read some of that stuff, and it doesn't make any sense. The translation doesn't bring across what was really going on. You ponder and you wonder, now what is that, you know? And yet the priest had it right there in front of them. They had all of those, well, they had the altar on the outside with the horns on it, and that's where all the sacrifices were sacrificed. The blood was poured all over and it ran down. They could take these Israelites and take their unblemished sacrifice and take them up there to the altar and show them some things about what was required to relate to God. And the primary one was, without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness. So the glory was made explicit by the temple service. And that means that there was a link in Paul's list that puts the service in parallel with the glory. The glory is the object of reality, and it's the hope that we're coming somehow, some way to an actual participation in it, in moral character. And the service in the temple became one of the most fundamental parts of the means because it made explicit what the words said by just taking them through the processes. Hebrews makes a lot of that. And then the third thing he says is they had the promises. Now, the promises are directly connected to covenants. Because what is a covenant except a promise that has been somehow codified or established in some kind of written in stone form? And that written in stone is very much like the law written in stone. It's written in stone. And in Ephesians 2:12, Paul says one of the tragedies of being a Gentile was that you were an alien from the covenants of the promise. So the covenants and the promise was there. They're connected. But they're connected in this sense. The promise made should be believable. I said this last week. But it's often not, simply because men are not inclined to believe what God just says. He's got to prove it. It's kind of like we heard this morning in the church service we were in, Zacharias being told by Gabriel that he's going to have a son and he's going to name him John. And what's Zacharias' reaction to that? How can I be sure this is going to really happen? And Gabriel penalizes him by making him mute so he can't speak until the son is born and named. And he says, this is because you didn't believe me. So the issue there is that there is a profound human tendency to disregard words that just come across as words. But covenants don't come across just as words. Covenants are codified. They're established. And in fact, in Galatians again, Paul says that with men, a covenant is basically an end to all the debate. Once it's signed, sealed, and delivered, and the judge has put his stamp on it, it's done deal. And you got to adhere to the realities of this commitment that you've made, this contract, because there are specific problems if you don't, and specific benefits if you do. And that's the kind of thing that God, according to Hebrews, God interposed with an oath, not because he had to. If he says it, it's going to be. But because men don't believe him. So he interposed with an oath so that those who are going to inherit in the kingdom would have strong encouragement to believe him. It's kind of like the ad on TV where the guy's making these promises to his wife and daughter, but the daughter keeps coming back in the growing ages of her life saying to Dad, "You promise? You promise?" Because if Dad just says it, that's no big deal. But if Dad promises, then the daughter feels like she's got him. Well, with God, a statement is a promise, and a covenant is, in a sense, it's a overreach. It's an excess. It's something he doesn't have to do, but he does it because of our weakness. And those promises are directly connected to the covenants, both in Ephesians 2:12, where the covenants of the promise are mentioned, but also in Hebrews 6:11 through 17, where God makes these oaths in addition to the statements, which are the promises, and he does it because man has to turn from his beginning point, which is self-confidence and a sense of independent action, to complete dependence upon the God of the promise, or promises, who, having made them, will then bring them to pass for everybody who trusts him to do so. God made these promises to Israel, but he didn't say to each individual Israelite, "You're going to get this whether you believe me or not." He never said that. He said, "This is my plan, and I expect you to believe me. If you don't believe me, you won't get it. It won't be your benefit." All of human history, from Genesis to Revelation, is revealed in the scripture to require that men believe what God says. And without faith, it's impossible to please him. And without pleasing him, you don't end up in the inheritance in the kingdom. So, in a very real sense, the problem is man's penchant for unbelief, and God interposes with oaths to address this weakness, but they're basically promises, and the covenants are the promises. So we've come full circle. He says you have the adoption, and the big part of the adoption issue is the giving of the law. You have the glory, and the big deal about that is the demonstration of the glory in the temple service. And you have the covenants, and the corollary to that's the promises, which are the same thing. Covenants are simply intensified. So what's Paul's point? His point is his sorrow and grief in regard to apostate Israelites is driven by his recognition that the only thing that stands between Israel and the blessedness of life is Israel's stiff-necked refusal to accept the messages of both law and promise. Because in the law, you had the revelation of man's depravity, and in the promises, you had a revelation of man's depravity, because God went to promise, because then it would depend on him to bring it to pass, because he couldn't trust man to bring it to pass. That's a terrible statement about the state of humanity, but it's the reality. When men fell into sin, it was an awful thing, and the only solution for it was some adjusting by the Godhead, in which the Son of God would accept the responsibility for all of the sins of humanity and pay the penalty for that. And the breach of the living God by the insertion of death into that triunity was a horrible and basically misunderstood, not understood concept of humanity. But that was the price of sin. And Israel didn't want to accept that evaluation of them because of their pride. So Paul labored under this sorrow and grief because he had been there. He knew exactly where they were. And he longed for them to come to faith. He would do whatever he could do. He was warned not to go to Jerusalem on his last trip to Jerusalem because they were going to bind him and turn him over to whoever and whatever. And he said, "I don't care. I'm going to go." And his whole reason for going was he still wanted to bear witness to Israel. So basically, the messages of the first three and the second three in this list of six are ultimately the same. And the message is this: trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not onto your own understanding. Or, any other human capacity you may have. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Let Him be the one who sets the agenda by promise and fulfills it in His own time and way. And that's where we are. As new creations in Christ, subject to the promises, it's our privilege and responsibility to believe them.